Blog Talk Radio.
Woman to woman, songs of life we sing, songs of love and songs of joy, songs of love. Sing it again.
Kayla, sing it down low for him. Sing it down low for him.
Joining us and tuning in to Woman for this evening, Wednesday. You may have heard me jump in a little bit earlier before the show actually started because I'm so thrilled and honored to be able to present this show to you this evening. But of course, I am one of your hosts, Minister LaDon, and we have our other host,
Coach D, is in the studio on tonight.
Thank you for that, Coach D. Yes, 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 indeed. We are so thrilled about this program that we're bringing to you this evening. We're super elated about this whole month, the series that we're bringing to you on domestic violence. And God has just really brought some tremendous ladies into our studio. And so you're going to be hearing entire month. Again, we're so super excited. So excuse me if I'm jumping ahead, because I can't wait for our special guest to just begin talking to all of our listeners this evening. And I'm going to step back just for a moment so that Coach D can tell you a little bit about our special guest. And then, of course, we'll have her join us in the studio and really get this program kicked off to a wonderful start. Coach D?
Well, thank you, Minister LaDon, my beautiful sister in Christ. I'm excited. You probably could hear the bubbling in my heart, and I'm excited because though domestic violence is not an excite, that's nothing to be excited about. Domestic violence, wow, it's at an all-time high when we think about what's going on in our nation right now. Domestic violence, abuse, sexual, all that falls up under domestic violence. And we know it's a lot going on, with domestic violence and abuse and just different things. We're at, the nation is at odds, you got people that's at odds with one another, what's right, what's wrong, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. And then to throw that in, you got the race factor, you got the race card factor, you got injustice and different things. So now people can't focus on the crime at hand, which is abuse, because now it's hard to focus on abuse when you have, across the board you have people committing the same crime, but certain people are not being held accountable for the same crime as others. So it's a lot going on in our nation right now. This is a very crucial time. We got elections coming up. We got so much to go on as women. As women alone, there's a lot that's on the election that we need to be aware of, even, as women. Not just as women, but as so there's a lot going on. So this would be, I think this is just a crucial time. October every year is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. But for some reason this month, it's hyphen. It's really important. It's always important, but it's noticeable because of what we're seeing on the news, what we're seeing going on in our nation. I was actually reading an article today about trafficking. And I might not say it right. I can't think. I want to say Minnesota or somewhere. But there are, like, all these women who are missing. Not just all of a sudden they all was missing, but over a period of time, it's like many women that are missing. And it's not news. It is not being spoken on the news. So, anyway, there's a lot in our nation that's going on. And so I'm excited because we have women, and I know I don't want to be prejudiced. There are men also that go through domestic violence. The difference is that women are speaking it. Women are saying, yes, I went through this. Yes, I was abused. Yes, I was misused. All these things. There are men that's going through it too that's not saying it because there's, it has to do with pride. It has to do with ego because nobody's expecting a woman to overpower a man. So you got men that's being domestically experiencing domestic violence that's not saying anything. But why I'm excited is because the women that are stepping up or the men that are stepping up, I'm excited because I believe through the season of transparency that when you want, I could imagine domestic violence is something that could really, you could easily not talk about. You could easily be still have the fears or the shame or whatever the thing may be, or the ridicule, why you stay, why you didn't know better, whatever. But I'm so proud of the women that are stepping up and say, hey, this is my story. But they're not stuck in their story because they're with the tragedy, they're giving a story of triumph. a story, a victorious story that's now turning into testimonies that's changing lives all over the world. So with that being said, I
Amen.
Want to introduce this and present to others our special guest in the studio. I have not gotten a chance to meet our guest personally, but I have gotten a chance to speak to her, and she was actually, we were introduced by a mutual friend who is just a mighty woman of God that's doing some mighty things. She was actually our guest that kicked the domestic violence series off last Wednesday, which she gave an awesome testimony, and she gave a lot of insight. So our guest that's in the studio on tonight, our special guest is Laverne J. Gordon, and Laverne is the president of Love Life Now Foundation Incorporated, and I am excited for her to be able to be in the studio and share with us her wisdom and her knowledge and her victory. Laverne, are you in the studio on tonight?
I am, and thank you for having me.
Oh, well, thank you. We are honored to have you. We're excited. We are just excited to hear from you on tonight, and we do truly believe that the listening audience will be encouraged, empowered, and educated through the words of your testimony. You are welcome into the
Amen.
Studio. Now, we know a little bit of something, but there's people out there that's listening that may know you, but there's many, because our audience is global, that do not know you. Can you please tell us, who is Laverne J. Gordon?
Gosh, well, first and foremost, a lover of God, a servant of God, a mom, a wife, and, wow, just a lover of helping anybody, especially when it relates, as it relates to the issue of domestic violence that you so poignantly talked about earlier. I, as you mentioned, I am the president of Love Life Now Foundation, and that came from my experience encountering domestic violence throughout my life. And I'm so happy that I'm able to be able to share what that looked like then versus what it is now tonight with the audience. So again, thank you for having me. Amen.
Oh, you are welcome. So Laverne, I think we're going to start off. You said that you're a wife and you're a mother, and right there, you know, when you talk about being a mother and a wife and a founder of an organization that's doing some powerful things helping women in these situations, why don't you tell us share with us a little bit about your ministry, your organization. What is it exactly that
Sure.
you all do?
Sure. So Love Life Now promotes year-round awareness against domestic violence. We don't want the issue to be in the forefront when something is in the news or an athlete is affected by it or a celebrity is affected by it. Too often you hear about these stories and they're quote-unquote glamorized, and then there's nothing else beyond that. And you don't necessarily hear about help. You don't necessarily hear about sort of the parameters that, you know, led to those circumstances. It's sort of spotlighted, and then it sort of dies down after a couple of days. And so we don't want that to be the issue. We want this issue talked about as much as possible because, as you mentioned earlier, it's not an issue that is, sort of wanting to be talked about. It's looked as taboo. It's looked upon as shameful. And many don't want to identify with it. Many who have been through it still don't necessarily want to be, you know, termed as a survivor because they think it's a shameful thing that they've just gone through, and they don't want people looking down on them. And so we try to keep the issue in the forefront through initiatives that we host locally here in the Boston area, in out of Massachusetts. You know, and a few of them that I'll name off are, seeing that it is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, it being October, is the homeless brown bag in care. When we think about domestic violence, we think about women primarily, and we think about women that are in a home that are primarily married to someone or in a relationship with someone. Well, the homeless are affected by domestic violence as well. And just in Massachusetts alone, 92% of women who are homeless have been affected by domestic violence, whether they were on the receiving end of it or it was the cause of their homelessness. And they end up on the street. And they don't know resources exist for them. So we go out and we meet them where they are at, with an incentive of a brown bag lunch that we put together and a bag full of toiletries that consists of hygienic items, so chapstick, deodorant, soap, those types of things, anything that gets them through the day hygiene-wise, and a lunch. And we meet them where they're at with those incentives for them to come talk to us. Too often we meet women that have been beaten the night before by their abuser, and they don't think that they deserve the help. They don't know that there is help. And even if, for some of them, if they, you know, decide that they are going to seek help, they don't want to get help because they, guess what, if they go file a restraining order, they have to go back out on the streets with their abuser, and they're afraid to even go that route. So we meet folks where they're at quarterly. Our next brown bag is coming up this Saturday, but that's just one of the incentives we do. Another popular one is our Heal-a-thon we host, where we ask men and women to come out in their comfiest pair of heels and walk a mile. The idea is to walk a mile in my shoes as a survivor and raise awareness and funding for a domestic violence agency that we choose. Also, in the dead of winter, we host what's called the White Ribbon Night Gala. And we asked men. It's centered around the White Ribbon campaign that asked more men to speak out on the issue. Too often you hear us as women advocating for the cause, but when a man is talking to another man about how he can be a part of the solution or digress from the behaviors that he is possibly doing as an abuser himself, it resonates that much more if it's coming from a man. So this particular gala, we ask folks, yes, to get dressed up, but that night is specifically geared towards men in the room, and we ask, you know, we have about maybe four men that come out and speak that particular night, maybe it's a local celebrity, someone that's doing the work in the community as an advocate, and a regular guy that is advocating, using his voice to advocate in whatever way throughout the year, whether it's through social media, through his company, through his colleagues, with someone that we recognize that is doing the work and using their voice to advocate for no more violence against women and children. We ask them to come speak. So those are just some of the initiatives that we host locally, what we do, and essentially the majority of our initiatives benefit a domestic violence agency. Just this month again, which is happening actually right now, this week we host a vetting drive. We ask folks to donate a new twin sheet and or pillow. Too often the residents of shelters, when they are fleeing to a shelter, they're fleeing with just the clothes on their backs and starting over, essentially. And the shelter and the agency, they get, you know, clothes and toiletries all the time, but not necessarily twin sheets and pillows, which is what they use for across the board for shelters. And so we ask folks to donate this new twin sheet and pillow, and those goods go back to a shelter that you choose. And so those, again, are just the initiatives that we hold locally. We also spotlight agencies throughout the state and abroad. I recently visited Bali in Indonesia and was able to highlight a shelter that is doing the work there as well. But wherever I visit in the States, we tend to, you know, highlight the agencies and shelters because folks need to understand that domestic violence happens everywhere. Even in the most beautiful places, there's a backstory of, tragedies that people are experiencing every day. And so we try to spotlight the fact that agencies like this exist everywhere, but the fact that domestic violence is happening everywhere and why help is needed. So we point people in the right direction for help. And we continuously, again, just keep this issue in the forefront as much as possible. One of the things that we don't necessarily share, but, you know, is that, you know, because we have gained a little bit more funding over the years, as we're able to, if the eight, you know, the shelters are full, 9 times out of 10, the shelters that I speak about are full, because that's the amount of calls that they're getting on a day-to-day basis. And so if for some reason, you know, someone in our area is not able to get into a shelter right away and, you know, the danger is imminent, we are able to put a victim up, you know, at an undisclosed motel, let's say, for a night or two. That way they can, you know, have some time to sort of sort out what's next. Too often you hear, you know, folks say on the outside looking in, well, why doesn't she just leave? Why is she staying? Why is she there? And it's not that simple. You know, you'll say to a victim, or someone will say on the outside, well, you know, that'll never be me. And, you know, why don't you just stay at her sister's? And it's not that simple. So because you have, as a victim, depended on your abuser, for whether it be financial security, whether it be to help take care of the kids, whether it be to, you know, whether he's putting the bills in the house, all of these, you know, just a whole number of reasons that I'll go through later on. And when it's time, you know, for you to leave, as mothers, we tend to put ourselves first. I mean, to put our children or others' needs first. And, you know, to think about picking up our children and, you know, going and, you know, staying at a shelter, you're scared of the unknown of what that may look like. You know, you'll say to yourself, which is, you know, sounds crazy to some people, but you'll say to yourself, well, you know, if I go, how are my kids going to eat? If I go, how are the bills going to be paid? If I go, who's going to put food on in their belly? You know, who's going to pick them up from school? Like, I don't have the means to sort of carry that out long term, and a shelter might only help me out short term. You know, they're weighing all their options. Obviously, the unknown is scary, of what starting over may look like since you've depended on this person for such a long time. But I want to backtrack how
before
I got
you
into
do that
work.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, before you do that, because you've given us so much information, and
yeah.
So, you know, I'm really thankful that people know a whole lot more about what to expect when they
mm-hmm.
do reach out for help and when they're walking towards, you know, they're seeking the support of shelters. And we're going to go into how you got started in this type of ministry and this type of support services. But one of the things that you mentioned earlier, you mentioned that you have men who come out and sometimes they tell their story. One of the questions that I wanted to ask, and it just really quickly, when you have these men who are telling their stories, are you having both the perpetrator and the victim that are volunteering to tell their stories, or is it usually somebody who's been victimized? Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. So that is in relation to the White Ribbon Campaign. The White Ribbon Campaign is a nationwide campaign that asks more men to speak up on behalf of women, but there are times that men will share when they come into that space what was done to them. And primarily, it's usually the men that have been victimized. With abusive, whether it's a woman who is the abuser or a man, abusers tend to often deflect. It's never their fault. So if it's hard enough for a man to come out and say that this has happened to me, think about the person that has done it to them. They almost often will not
sure.
say that
yeah.
they are that person. They are almost always deflecting and placing the blame on their victims, which sets
Got
our
it.
Victims into this psyche that they are less than, they are the cause of what's happening, and causes them to stay a lot of the time in these relationships.
You know,
over time, they believe that they are the problem.
When you mentioned that, when you said that, I was not there, so I can't swear to or swear on behalf of, but when you said that, it made me think of what's going on in our country today with the Kavanaugh trials, where, the example that you just gave just kind of tend to shine a light for me. And again,
yeah.
I can't, swear that he did do anything or didn't do anything, but
right.
he just kind of matches that behavior that
yeah.
you just mentioned. So, anyway,
yeah.
I guess we'll move away from that before anybody gets offended. But one of the things I did want you to go ahead and do is, kind of share about what made you step out and get into supporting women who've been through domestic violence. How did your life lead you to where you are today?
Yeah, so before the show started, I mentioned that I'm originally from Trinidad, and I lived there from the time I was born up until 1993. However, I grew up in a very poor area, the hood is what I will just say it was. I grew up in the hood, but my father in that area was considered lower middle class. And for the span of the time that I knew myself up until I was 15, which is when I migrated to the States, my father brutally abused my mother in front of us. There were five of us, and I was the middle child. And he did not hide to do what he did. Unfortunately, in the area that I grew up, it was typically the norm for husbands to beat their wives or their spouses or their girlfriends. It was a weekly occurrence a lot of times where the beatings would happen. We're not talking a slap or a kick. We're talking, and I'll be brutally honest, we're talking machetes that he would use on her. We're talking beer bottles that he would break and stab her with at times. And these are things that happened in front of us as children that we were left to sort of deal with because my mom was so scared of. Now, there were many times that she left. There were many times that she ran away, but she would come back. I asked her many years later why she stayed and why didn't she stay gone when she did leave. There were times that she would take myself and my younger brother, who was 2 years younger than me. She would typically take us and run because the two older ones were grown and moved out of the house at the time, and my youngest brother was not born yet. And so I asked her, why didn't you stay gone? Because what she didn't understand was that when we were away, we were the happiest. However, she was concerned that he was the breadwinner and that she could not take care of us beyond a day or two, or stay in someone's home beyond a day or two, or that he would eventually, which a lot of the times happens, he would eventually find her, sort of apologize, and then we would end up back in the home. So these
wow.
beatings happened, and, it left me, and my siblings in fear. He was very strict, and he demanded much of us of us as children. My two older siblings were about 7 years apart, and they also were 2 years apart in age as brother and sister. I watched them coming up and realized that his form of discipline on them was also abuse, not as brutal as my mother's, but certainly not the way you would discipline children at any given point. So they would get beatings as well, and I realized, I said, I am going to do my best to try to stay on this man's good side so that I don't get the beatings that they did. And it worked for the most part. He demanded us, to go to school, get a good education. I tried to do that as much as possible. And by the time I was 15, my grandparents, who lived in the States at the time, asked for me to come out to finish high school there. They thought that I would have greater opportunity based on, you know, the level of education that I was receiving and, you know, with the way I was doing school. And, you know, for all intent and purposes, time growing up, I always said that I would never let anybody treat me the way my father treated my mother. And I went with that, and I grew with that. I mean, child's play for me was gathering the kids in the neighborhood and playing judge and jury. I would always be the judge or I would always be the lawyer because in my mind I said I would grow up and prosecute people like my father, including my father. That's the way I was going to get back at him, right? So, you know, I grew up and, you know, migrated to the States. I left my mom and my dad. My dad let me go because he saw potential, and my siblings stayed back as well as my mom. And I finished high school here, and I started college, and but not before I went back to Trinidad to get my permanent residency sort of situated at the time. And so by the time I came back, I was 18. I was 19 at the time. And going on 20. And by the time I was 21, I was working at an entry-level corporate America job position and going to school at night, college at night. And I met this guy. And it started off sort of him trying to get me to date him. And at the time, I was so focused on school that I didn't think I had time for any of that. So, you know, he tried really hard for about, I don't know, maybe a month and a half. And then I finally decided, you know what? I am going to go out with him. So we started dating. And for about 3 months, things were great. He was, you know, picking me up to go on these lavish dates. And, you know, just being very a great gentleman, opening car doors and, you know, just the very nice things about courting that I truly enjoyed. About the 3 month mark, I started suffering from allergies for the first time, and so bad that I called into work and said that I wasn't coming in that particular morning. And so I sort of, you know, made that call and went back to bed. And about 10 minutes later, he called my cell phone and was very irate that I hadn't checked in with him that morning. One of the signs of an abusive power and control relationship is that they want to know where you are at all times. They want to, you know, make sure that even if you're not with them, that you are where you are, where you say you are. And this was one of the signs that I neglected to sort of look at and didn't realize that it was leading to where it was going. And so every morning we would talk at least 5 or 6 times before I got to the office. And even by the time I got to the office, he would call my desk multiple times during the day. If I wasn't at my desk, he would be very sort of leery and sort of suspicious as to why I hadn't called him back. You know, I would sort of brush it aside as, oh my gosh, he really cares about me, and he's really trying to check in and make sure I'm okay. But this particular morning, he was very irate that I hadn't checked in with him, and I told him, you know, I'm feeling a little sick. Are you going to come bring me some chicken soup? And he said, chicken soup? And he hung up the phone, and within 10 minutes, 15 minutes or so, he was at my house. At the time, I had now lived, my mom and my two younger siblings had moved to the States, and we were now living in my grandparents' home. And this particular day, everybody had left and gone to work or school. And he came to my door and barged in past me and went into my room and started sort of rummaging through my things, looking behind the curtain, looking under the bed, and sort of asking me irately who was here. And I said, nobody was here. He said, you know, you didn't check in with me, so I know something's up. Who did you have here that you didn't want to call me this morning? And he got so red in the face. He was light-skinned, so his face turned beet red, and, you know, I started getting very scared. And I said, you know, you're really scaring me. I'm sitting at the edge of the bed, and he's standing over me. And before I knew it, he slapped me for the first time so hard that I saw stars. Stormed out of the room saying that I was this, that, called me out my name and left, saying that he saw, he knew that I was too good to be true. And left the room, and I sat there trying to figure out what just happened. What did I do to cause that? You know, just sort of blaming myself, saying that maybe I should have called him. You know, it was our typical routine every morning, and I didn't do it, so he had a right to be angry. And then I caught myself, and I said, you know what? No, I didn't do anything. It wasn't me. I don't have any ties to him, so this relationship is over. That particular weekend, I had made my mind up at the time that I was done. And so that particular weekend, I had made a gesture to myself. I said that I was going to go to New York and shop and, you know, take, I don't know if you remember the buses back in the day that would sort of, I don't know if it happens in your area, but, you know, there were buses in Chinatown that would take you all the way to New York, the Chinese bus, the Greyhound, the equivalent of the Greyhound, that would take you to New York where you could shop from, like, you know, the early bus would probably get there at about 10 and you could shop all day and get back on the bus and head back rather about 6 o'clock. So I had promised myself that I was going to give myself that gift for my birthday weekend, and I did that. I went and I turned my phone off to save my minutes. This is 1999 at the time, so prepaid cell phones and, you know, nights and weekends being free were a thing. So I turned my phone off, and A, because I wanted to save my minutes, and B, I didn't want to hear from him. And by the time I came back, my brother met me at the door, and he said, you're pretty popular around here. Such and such has been looking for you. And I said, why? He said, well, they left a gift for you. And I went in, and my favorite color is purple. He had left a dozen purple roses for me and with a note that said, I miss you, I love you, I'm sorry, please call me, I'm worried. And when I turned my phone on...
I want you to continue your story, but I just want to throw this point out for our listening audience because something you said was so key. You guys had been dating for 3 months, and he was calling consistently. And so, you know, women, a lot of times we think that's so cute.
Yeah.
We think it doesn't register that there may be something wrong with that.
Right.
We think, oh, wow, he's really into me. This is so cute. And so it is a total surprise and a shock when something happens that's adverse because you're thinking, you know, this is a relationship that he's checking in on me. Exactly.
Yeah.
I just wanted to throw that in there because, you know, my mind was thinking, how do we get to that place? And that was one of the things that you said that made me think, this is kind of a way that we get there. So let me jump back out to the purple roses and let you continue.
Yeah, but no, I do want to say and agree that it is a huge red flag that someone is secure, that is, you know, believes you and loves you, does not do that. they are not concerned 24/7 about your whereabouts, who you're talking to, you know, what you're wearing, and all these signs that we neglect to recognize as signs because we think that what we have or what we're experiencing in the now is never going to happen again with anybody else. We think that this is where it's at. This is the best it's ever going to get. And that's simply not true. And so that first apology that I got, which was indeed the first of many, I took. I took the amount of voicemails that were left about him being worried, that he was, you know, very concerned about where I was and how sorry he was and the purple roses that he took time to figure, you know, to realize that purple was my favorite color and deliver them. And it just was nothing that I had ever experienced before. And even watching or, you know, the immediate sort of sense that came over me once I listened to the messages and realized that he had brought the roses was, you know, my father never apologized to my mother the way he was doing right now. And so maybe it isn't that bad. You know, it was just a slap. And he is saying he's sorry. And look at the length that he went to say he's sorry. You know, it's okay. I guess it's okay. And, you know, and again, maybe it was my fault. Maybe I should have called. And maybe me not calling him all weekend or responding to his messages was kind of harsh. So I took that apology, and that turned into 2 years of abuse. The next time he hit me, and thereafterwards, it was never about the face. He realized that I worked in a corporate setting and that any marks on my skin would show. It was always punches about the body, kicks and, you know, punches on the upper torso or my leg area, places that people couldn't see. And
yeah.
Oftentimes you'll hear survivors talk about, you know, I wish because the marks and the emotional, you know, the physical scars, you know, they go away, and but the emotional scars can last a lifetime. And it's so true, because I became so numb to the physical blows over the years that it was more numbing to hear his voice and the words that he said sort of scathing through me, because those are the things that set in and stayed with me. The next time he hit me, and we were at a club, maybe about less than a month later, and he walked away to get some drinks and came back. And as he was coming back, or while he was at the bar, rather, a gentleman tried to come and talk to me. And I immediately got scared because I knew his way of thinking by then. And I just wanted the guy to just sort of go. I said, you know, my boyfriend's at the bar. He's coming back soon. Please, can you just walk away? And the guy just, you know, was trying to tell me. He said, I'm just trying to tell you, you look nice. What's your deal? And at the same time, you know, my boyfriend was coming back, and, you know, he saw, you know, sort of an exchange happening. And when he approached, the guy then walked away, and he then said to me, he said, what did you do to invite him over here? Were you looking at him? Is that what you want? Is that the type of guy you want? And, you know, me trying to explain, that's not what it was, and he didn't want to hear it. He left the club immediately, and on our way home, we had to take the highway to get to my house. Which we had, my mother and my two brothers had moved into, myself and my two brothers moved into at the time. You know, we had to get to take the highway. He was driving erratically on the highway enough to make me think that I was going to die that night, because I was thinking he was going to crash the car with both of us in it. He was punching and reaching across the passenger seat to punch me in my body and yell and, you know, say things like, you know, call me up my name and just really nasty things. And so he dropped me off that night at about 1 o'clock in the morning and sped off, didn't wait for me to get inside or anything. And I got into my bedroom, and all I could think about was, how can I fix this? How can I make him understand that he's the only one that I want? And that, you know, it's just him and I. And so repeated calls to him that night that he wouldn't answer, up until maybe the 20th call that I had made to him apologizing for what had happened, and him saying to me, you know, that I love you so much that it hurts to see me talking to anybody else, and, you know, he's sorry, and, you know, just wanted to reassure him. And so one of the things that I want to point out is that, you know, we as women, we, from early on, we are taught to be polite, to make things work, to fix things, to be the fixer of things. And we grow up with that mentality, making us, you know, sort of head into the relationship feeling like we must be the fixer of all things, including broken folks that come to us broken, that we realize that we don't realize that we can't fix. And so that was the mentality for sure on my end, because my mother, for many years, she tried to fix it. She cooked better, she cleaned better, she was more quieter when she got the blows, because my father would say, you know, be quiet, you know, even though he's like brutally beating her. She, over the years, her screams became whimpers. You know, it's just all of these things that you grow up and you tell yourself that will never be me. Unfortunately,
yeah.
Parents are the first directors of what our relationships look like, or what we're taught by them or by our parents, what relationships can look like. And so for
mm-hmm.
me, even though I inherently said that would never be me, subconsciously it was already set in my mind the way men are supposed to treat women. And so I took that, and so the second meeting happened, and the third, and the fourth, and the fifth, and the sixth, and the seventh. And it went on and on until, you know, there was a period that I was homeless with him because he got into it with my brother, who never knew the extent of the abuse that I was receiving because I was too ashamed. I was too ashamed and too afraid of being blamed. You know, knowing what our mother went through, I was too ashamed of people looking at me and saying, how could you let yourself fall into that type of relationship knowing what your mother went through? And so, you know, I just kept it to myself. But they knew. People know from the outside looking in that things aren't right. And they definitely knew that things weren't right. And so they never really got along with him. And until one particular time, my brother got into it with him and the police were called. And I took my boyfriend's side because it was this Bonnie and Clyde, you know, sort of mentality that you don't understand him and you don't understand us. And, you know, I'm leaving. So, I took whatever I could and I left with him. And he at the time didn't have, you know, any place that he was staying. Go ahead.
Ask you one question really quickly and still allow you to move on with the story. And then, of course, if we have anybody in the listening audience who wants to ask a question, please press 1 on your dial pad, and our team will know that you want to join the conversation and they'll bring you in. But while we're waiting for that, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, during all of this, was there ever a time where it appeared that your mother knew or that she asked you if anything was going on? Like, did your mom know?
Multiple times. And multiple times I lied. Multiple times I downplayed, you know, maybe a mark that was, you know, sort of left open on my, you know, like I wore a short sleeve. And she may have seen something and she, you know, she would, like, literally want to shake it out of me. Like, is this happening to you? And if so, what, why? What are you doing? You know, this, you're smarter than this. You're like the smartest. And I don't understand. And, you know, immediately I would clam up because there was no way that I was, you know, admitting to that, you know, this thing. I didn't even know that it was, you know, termed domestic violence at the time, but whatever this was, whatever she had experienced, I was not willing to equate myself with what she had went through. I consistently downplayed it because I kept saying, well, you know, he's not beating me in the open in front of our neighbors. That happened to her, and that's not happening to me. Everybody knew, you know, I work a corporate America job and I'm going to school at night. So it's not that bad. I can leave anytime I want, but that was not the truth. That was never the case. And so there was just no way that I was admitting. And again, all my family members sort of knew something. But I would never let on that that's what it was. And so by this time, I decided that I was just going to live in his car with him until we found somewhere to live. I was homeless for about 2, maybe 3 weeks. At the time,
and you know, I'm going to jump in really quickly. Your story is so amazing to hear, and I'm sure a lot of people are being healed. But we do have a question from our listening audience. And so while we have you as a resource, I want to make sure that they get the full advantage of having you to bless them. So, Denise, can you take over with our listener?
Yes. Well, ask you the questions from me.
Hi.
So I love it. Before I ask my question – I will speak to the audience. If we have anyone in our listening audience that have a question or a comment about tonight's show, please feel free to dial 1 on your dial pad. That'll let our team know that you have a question or comment. Does anyone have a question or comment about tonight's show? Okay, awesome. So I do. At any time, you can dial 1 on your dial pad, and that'll let our team know that you have a question or comment. So I don't want you guys to think that I'm stepping over you, but at any time, we'll take your comment. But my question is this, and I'm asking the question, and you know, I know the answer, I believe, but I just want to know. Because you had said something key, and I thought that was very profound, because you said he wasn't doing he didn't do it like my father did it, so I felt like it was okay. And when you said that, I was going to ask a question right before you said that, but you kept talking and you said that. And my question was this, is domestic violence only physical?
No. And so I mentioned earlier about the emotional scars that this issue leaves and stays, and it'll sort of plague you for life, because it is emotional as well, and it is mental / psychological. So it can come in those forms. And people, you know, at the time, you know, all I knew of what I, again, not the term domestic violence, but all I knew of this thing that my mother had went through, this evil thing, was the physical. And I didn't equate it with the other things that my father did over the years to her, you know, which was the financial abuse, where he withheld money from her. He would give her a certain amount, sort of a stipend to sort of make the groceries for the house. But, you know, never gave her money for clothes, per se, unless it was in the form of an apology to buy a skirt or a dress or something. There were the nicks at her self-esteem where, you know, you are so ugly, nobody's, and then my mother is beautiful. I don't know about your mother, but my mother's beautiful, okay? But he would nick at her self-esteem every chance he got. He would nick at the way she cooked, and she's a phenomenal cook. He would nick at the way, you know, she dressed at times, you know, just anything, or, you know, talk about her hair, just anything to downplay. And to put this into perspective, when my father and my mother met, she was a model for department store clothing in Trinidad. She also modeled clothing for designers at the time in Trinidad, and entered, you know, beauty pageants and stuff like that. So, you know, to come into a relationship where all of that is sort of chipped away at slowly with these sort of nicks, and, you know, that never resonated with me, because all I could see was the physical. However, when I entered into my relationship, I realized that, and, you know, many years later, sort of coming into my own with this issue, I realized that the things that he said and he did, from the very beginning, was emotional abuse. So sort of talking about, you know, how I wore my hair, sort of, you know, degrading, sometimes the way that I dress, nicking away at my, you know, whenever there was an attack, saying that nobody would ever want me after he was done with me. And so therefore, he's the only one that loves me and can love me the way that he does. And so all of those things sort of culminated, and there are many other forms of emotional abuse that sort of kind of compile under, you know, some of the forms that abusers sort of display it onto their victims. But a lot of the times, those are at the forefront, nicking away at your self-esteem, you know, withholding things from you that should be readily available to you in a relationship, sort of chipping away again at, you know, who you are, who they met you as, to sort of bring you down so that they have sort of that power and control over you until you have nothing else. And you have nothing else but to depend on this particular person. So by that point, us being, you know, living in his car and me having this Bonnie and Clyde attitude, people don't understand. They'll never understand because he's not always like this. You know, there are the good days. And I would sort of put that, you know, sort of ahead of, you know, the amount of bad days that I experienced, that gloss over all of the bad things that I was experiencing. Because when it was good, it was good. When we made up, it was glorious making up. But when things were bad, they were really, really bad. And sort of the bad would sort of outweigh the good, but always sort of gloss over it with, it's going to get better. I know he can change. And, you know, maybe if I cry enough tears, he'll understand that he's hurting me and he can't do this anymore. Maybe if I stick around a little bit longer, he'll understand that this isn't working and he needs to love me better. And, you know, if I do decide to seek help, well, then he'll get in trouble and I'll mess up his job, and I don't want that. Over the course of the relationship, I came to find out that he had children that I was not aware of, and a full-on other relationship that he was a part of that I was not aware of when I entered the relationship. He sort of, and if this makes any sense, he sort of paraded me as the trophy girlfriend, but had a baby mother that I was not aware of for, this was now probably 7 months in that I found out that he had children with another woman, and lived with her. So when, you know, we were homeless, it was to the point where he was bringing me to his friend's house to, you know, to shower up, and I would go to, I worked in sort of the heart of Boston at the time. And so there was a big mall that was close to my job. So there were times that I would go into the bathroom at this mall, at the crack of dawn and wash up before I went to work, or he would bring me to his friend's house. But I never went to where he lived because he claimed that he roomated with people and he never wanted to bring me there. And so that lasted for about two to three weeks, and until I found my own apartment. I then moved into a studio apartment, and that's when the abuse escalated to another level that it wasn't before, because now I was in my own space, and, you know, I certainly wasn't letting on to my neighbors that things were happening. This was an apartment building with a bunch of professionals that lived in said building. And I certainly didn't want any of them to know what was happening to me because I was too ashamed. And so, you know, again, I thought if, you know, he saw that, you know, now I have an apartment and he can come there whenever he wants and things would get better, instead of just escalated, because he knew now that I was not speaking to anybody and that I would not tell anybody, and that I was even in a more sort of isolated space, that I was never led on to what's happening. This is now almost 2 years into the relationship, and one particular night he came in, and I knew that he was upset about something because he started sort of accusing me of, you know, having someone there during the day, and, you know, who was here, and started rummaging through my things and looking for quote-unquote evidence. And he came upon this stack of books that had moved with me over the years. One of them was a book by, you know, Terry McMillan, Waiting to Exhale. And this book had moved with me from the time that I had migrated to the States. And he, you know, rummaged through all these novels, and that particular one had a picture that fell out, and he picked it up and looked at it, and I think the reddest that I had ever seen him, he turned that shade of red, and he looked at it, and he said, "I'm going to kill you tonight," and he flung the picture at me, and I said, you know, the picture sort of fell on the floor. I was sitting on the bed, on my day bed at the time, And I picked it up, and I looked at it, and I immediately died inside because I knew what he could be thinking. And so this was a picture of myself and an ex-boyfriend of mine in Trinidad, who, when I moved to the States, we said that we were going to do the long-distance thing, and obviously that did not work out. That lasted about 2 weeks. So this picture I had used as a bookmark when I had just moved to the States, and my aunt had given me this particular book to read, and I think I read it cover to cover 6 times, and then put the book down, and the picture stayed in there. And so when he saw that picture, it was both of us sort of sitting on the beach in Trinidad, hugged up arm in arm, he immediately flew into this rage and went into the kitchen, and for the first time, for any attack, he grabbed a weapon, he grabbed a knife, and he came back into the room and he said, "I'm going to kill you." He said, "You've been taking me for a fool this entire time, and I don't know what you've been doing. What have you been sending money to this guy? Have you guys been having phone sex?" And he just, all of these outrageous things that he started accusing me of. And so this time now I'm trying to, convince him that nothing is going on, that picture is so old. It means nothing to me. He meant nothing to me, and he didn't want to hear it. He sort of straddled me on my daybed and held a knife up against my neck enough to let me know that he could slit my throat at any time. And so he started pressing the knife and then saying that, when I kill you tonight, that nobody's going to find you. And he was right, because by this time I was isolated from my parents, my mom, my parents, my extended family, my cousins, my brothers. I didn't want anything to do with them because, again, they didn't understand us. I sort of took them as the reason that we were home, that I became homeless and that I was forced to be in this situation. And he was right that if he had, severely damaged me or killed me, that nobody would find me for days. He pressed the knife. He then put the knife down and started punching me, slapping me and punching me in the face for the first time ever since the first time he had hit me in my face. This was now the second time that he was hitting me in my face. He was spitting in my face. He was yelling profanities. He was calling out my name. And then he would get up the floor and sort of say things that he was thinking. Just the most vile things that I had ever heard come from him. And then he would start again, punching, kicking, pressing the knife against my neck and sort of nicking me almost. And so that started at about 9 o'clock that night and went on till 2 o'clock the next morning, off and on, off and on.
And Laverne, I want to make sure that we're super sensitive to your story because we're actually at the end of our show, and I don't want the show to cut off on you. So,
absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. I'm just like, I'm torn because
yeah.
I'm like, okay.
I'll wrap by saying this. I took myself to the hospital, and the doctor in the ER room looked at me and said, "I can help you because I've seen these types of injuries before." And helped me meant going to a shelter in a big open room with beds with a bunch of women that I didn't know. And that was a no for me because I didn't want to be blamed or shamed or my job to find out or anybody else to find out. And so I denied everything and got treatment and thankfully was diagnosed with upper contusions of the hip and the torso area, which meant he punched so hard that the inner flesh was bruised from all this and it was swollen from all the punches that I had gotten that night. And so I was able to go home, but fast forward 10 years later is when I was tasked with starting a nonprofit. And that's the reason why we bring in high-life shelters and resources, because I, at the time, didn't know what help could look like and was too afraid of making that next step. And so I just urge folks that if you are in these types of relationship like this, whether it's verbal, emotional, or psychological, that you do realize that it is toxic, it is never going to get better, and that you do need to seek help. I know it's only until you get to your breaking point, because it doesn't matter how much we on the outside say you should leave, until that person decides and realizes that it's no more, that they can't take it anymore, that's the only time that they're going to seek help. But when you do, reach out and know that people are there to help you. The National Domestic Violence Hotline number is 1-800-799-SAFE, 1-800-799-SAFE. So if it's the last thing you do, research about the help that is out there, reach out to someone, and break that silence, because that's how abusers lose their power and control over you, by you speaking up. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
You know, one of the things that
Can
you repeat? I wanted Laverne to repeat that number again, because I think it was short, about three numbers.
Yeah, so it's 1-800-799-SAFE. So the letters that correspond to the
phone,
I believe it's 26. I'm not computing, but 7623 is what I think it relates to. SAFE.
Okay.
S is a Sam, A is an apple, F is a Frank, E is an egg.
Awesome, awesome. Okay, I didn't hear the safe part. I just heard 1-800-799. I was like, okay, we're missing some numbers. Okay, so, okay, safe.
Go ahead, Laverne.
I was just going to say that I was able to get out by finally filing a restraining order, because once I got to my breaking point, which was that particular night, realizing that I could have died and nobody would have found me, and finally seeking help, that turned into stalking. When I finally said no more and I didn't want to do this anymore, he couldn't take no for an answer. He couldn't believe that I was the one saying this is over, you know. And it's that mentality that if I can't have you, nobody can. And so we talk about victims, and we see these stories on the news all the time that why don't you just leave? It's not that black and white, because it's the most dangerous time for victims is when they decide to leave. And which is why I urge victims to seek help, because being able to safety plan with an advocate that can help you navigate about ways to leave and leave safely is crucial. An abuser hearing that you are done and you can't do this anymore is like mind-boggling to them, and they would rather see you dead or not, you know, not alive or hurting the way that they are hurting, which is crazy to think about, but that's what it is. That's what it boils down to. So I urge you to seek help. It is the most dangerous time when victims are trying to leave. And I, thankfully, after getting, you know, into that talking phase, filed a restraining order, and my abuser adhered to it and disappeared. But a lot of people aren't that lucky. So please understand, when you see or you say to yourself, why doesn't she just leave? Why doesn't he just leave? It isn't that black and white. It isn't that simple. There's too many factors that play into getting out and getting out safely.
Amen. You know, one of the things I want to add to that before we close, I really want to make sure to point out, again, at the top of the show, we talked about how in the nation there's, you know, so many stories that we have the Me Too movement going on. We have the whole Kavanaugh Ford trial going on. But we know that when things are done in the natural, it's reflected of what's going on in the spirit. And so there's been a light that's being shined upon, and these things are being not able to be hidden anymore. And so when things are not hidden, healing and rebuilding can go forth. And so I'm mentioning that because unless we're transparent, unless we're willing to tell our story, one of the biggest things that we leave and we regenerate is those women that are raising those children are growing those children in shame and guilt. That's the only thing that they can pass on to those children, because we sometimes think that there's a strength that's being passed on. And I'm saying that because I, too, grew up in a home where there was a lot of domestic violence going on and even child abuse going on. And so we think our children will be stronger, especially if we go through this and, you know, we survive and we teach our children. But our children, you know, you learn, you can't do what you can't see.
Right.
And so even though they think they're becoming stronger, there's still a weakness, there's still a shame, and there's still – still a guilt that's being threaded through the raising up of these children. And so when we began to tell our story, the biggest thing that we lift is that cloud of guilt. We lift that cloud of shame. And we also began to teach people how to recognize the signs of what abuse looks like. Before, we didn't realize that emotional and mental abuse were signs that could lead to physical abuse. Go ahead, Laverne. I just wanted to definitely want you to be able to speak.
Yeah, no, I'm just in agreement with you that, you know, and it doesn't just fall on the mothers. I, for a long time, guilted. I felt that my mom could have done better when I didn't know sort of the power and control that she was under. But as a child witness to this, and now grown, and I've gone through my own abusive relationships, and now understand the parameters of what that entails, I can never fault her. But to the extent that there wasn't that help. There wasn't that help that existed at the time, third world country in the 80s, the term domestic violence is in terms at that time. But essentially, we should understand that both parents, if there are both parents in the home, we are both responsible for what our children learn from us as it relates to relationships. And we are the first teachers to them. And so fathers teach their daughters the way men are supposed to treat them. Fathers teach their sons the way they're supposed to look at women and view them, and vice versa. Mothers teach their sons how treating a woman is. So we look at all these things, and we say to ourselves that once you know better, you're able to do better, and why it's so important to keep resources in the forefront as much as possible. Yes, it is to the point where, you know, at the time, we don't know why victims are staying in these relationships a lot of the times. We say to ourselves, we think, well, you know, like you said, like one of the reasons is, hey, you know, we're teaching our children to be stronger. But so much more complex issues. There are women that are in relationships, these relationships that are brought here from other countries with the promise from their abusers that, hey, once you get to the States, I'll marry you. Or I'll marry you right now and I'll move you to the States and, you know, all will be good and you'll become a citizen and things will go great. Well, guess what? When they get here, the abuse escalates, there's no marriage, and they're stuck. So, quote, every day they're being told, if you say anything, I will call the police and have you deported. And victims don't understand that the police and immigration don't work together. The police don't care about your immigration status. The police are there to protect you. But they don't know that. All they know is what's being told by their abusers. So when you have victims that are in these relationships and they're hearing over and over and over again that if you leave me and you take my children, I will find you and I'll kill them and I'll kill you, find you and I'll kill you and I'll take my children, or I'll take my children and I'll go for custody and you will never see them again. All of these things, all of these barriers, all of these sort of things that are held over your head day in and day out, cause you to live in fear, cause you to not ever want to make a move, cause you to say that I'll stick it out for the sake of the children. You know, all of these things keep women or victims in general in these relationships. We think about, you know, gay and lesbians. You know, you think, well, that shouldn't even be happening. But that exists. And they are being told, if you say anything, I will out you. I will make it known to the world of your status, even though you've told me that I haven't come out to my parents yet. You know, I'm just sort of covering all the areas where and the reasons why victims stay and why it should that should never be the question, but it should be why is this person doing this to them? And how can how can intervention happen on abusers' behalf? How can we hold abusers accountable and not have them stay 90 days in jail or go take an anger management course, but really hold them accountable for what they're doing to victims on a daily basis?
Definitely. And, you know, one of the things I definitely want to leave with our listeners is that, you know, now is the time to really start to change our minds about what's okay and what's not okay. I heard or read a report where and saw a video where some of the mothers were saying that, oh, you know, 18-year-old boys or high school boys, they grope girls. That's not a big thing. We have to begin to be outraged by what's going
like
on. And when we become outraged, it causes us to become sensitive to the climate, sensitive to what our young people and even older people are experiencing. But when we began to train our children up properly, knowing the process, and the only way that they can know the process or know how to recognize things again is by us as parents or us as community members not being afraid to say, you know what, this happened to me, and these are some of the things that occurred when it was happening, so that when someone else finds themselves in those shoes, they can say, you know what, this is the sign before I start to get hit, or this is the sign before I start to get abused. So this is the time to do something now, and they have that freedom to make those decisions before they even get into the experience of being abused. Because when we sweep things up under the rug, a lot of times
that's where it stays. It's only happening
to me.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, where that starts is really in our schools. When we think about our babies that are going to school, yes, they have influence from us at home, but then they're spending 8+ hours a day at school where their peers are.
Yeah.
And we do workshops at high schools and middle schools, and I can tell you that 90% of the time after I've given a workshop, a healthy relationship workshop, 90% of the time at least 2 to 3 girls are coming up to me saying that, A, they are experiencing this. Well, you know, he calls me a lot, so, you know, I just thought it was cute. You know, that shows he loves me if he wants to know. He's always telling me what to wear and stuff. But because they're seeing that at home, they think it's normal, or their friends are going through it, and they think, well, okay, this is absolutely what a relationship is about. Or you'll have kids saying, my mom is experiencing it, and I don't know what to do. I don't know where to get help. Or that a friend is going through it, and I don't know what to tell her. I don't know how to help her get. So this is happening way early. I'm talking 14, 15, 16-year-olds, and where the cycle is progressing through, you know, with our kids coming up, right? And so intervention at that level is needed more. Awareness on that level is needed more, because that's where relationships are being formed and then taken out into, you know, the college level, you know, where, you know, it progresses into even more violent behavior. And, you know, rape and sexual assault, domestic violence on campuses are kept quiet. But, you know, so it's a cycle that, you know, sort of perpetuates, A, like you said, because people aren't speaking up, or B, because it's being perpetuated, you know, at a very early age, where folks are seeing it and sort of mirroring, as I said, what their parents, you know, sort of leaving sort of behind as to what relationships can look like. So there's so many factors, picking up awareness, which is what we focus on at the foundation, and just being aware, even as bystanders, even if this has never affected you and you don't think this will ever affect you, the stats I will point out is that 1 in every 4 women will be abused in their lifetime. 1 in every 3 teens and 1 in every 7 men. And so if you're a bystander and you see something, I'm not asking you to get physically involved, that you could get yourself hurt, because we don't know what the abuser has on their person. But if you're driving by and you see an altercation in a car, in the car next to you, you know that that does not look right, you call the police. You get a license plate. You call the police anonymously and you get help. If you're walking down the street, you call the police anonymously. If you see something, you say something every single time. Because more often, that victim will not pick up the phone and call themselves because they're too afraid, for all the reasons that I named and then some earlier. But if you call, at least there's a report on file that all is not right at 123 Blueberry Lane. So always, always say something as a bystander.
And you know, of course, we're at the end of the show. We're at the time that for us to close. And you, thank you guys for joining us, our listening audience. Thank you so much, Laverne, for being in studio with us and just all of the information that you've given us this evening. Listening audience, I want you guys to know that we could go on with this show because, you can tell, Laverne is so passionate about making sure that there's resources out there available and that you know how to do something today in this moment right now to change your life so that you don't have to become a statistic of someone who possibly ended up dead or, you know, staying in that type of relationship and, you know, forever or way entirely too long. So
yeah.
You hear the passion from her. I want you guys to know that you, before we close out, we'll allow Laverne to give her information so that you guys can find her on Facebook. But before we do that, of course, I want to remind you guys that we're here every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. And this month, of course, is our October Domestic Violence Awareness Month. It's all over the nation, but our show is dedicated to bringing you in every broadcast this month so that we can shine light on domestic violence. So we want you to tune in and join us every Wednesday. But not only join us on Wednesdays, we also want you to join us on Thursdays because on Thursdays, Coach D will be bringing to you Processing the Pain. So even if you've been through something like domestic violence or, you know, just different challenges in life, that show helps you. It gives you resources. It gives you tools. It gives you the opportunity to talk and learn about how to process the pain that you've gone through. And, of course, that show is at 7 p.m. on Thursdays, each and every Thursday of the month. And as we close, I'm going to ask, of course, Coach D if she has anything to add. Allow her to close out, and in the end, of course, I want Laverne to please, please, please give her information one more time so that anybody who's listening can reach out and contact and get the help that they need. Amen?
Amen.
Amen.
Go ahead, Sister Laverne.
No, go ahead, Laverne, and then that way after you do that, then I'll close out.
Got it. Okay, so our website, where you there's a tab for resources, agencies that we have dealt with over the years that, you know, not just in the state of Massachusetts, but throughout the world, really, that we've traveled, is www.lovelifenow.org. And click on the tab resources, and you can find links to agencies maybe in your area. And if not, you can always reach out to me. My phone number is on the website. And I can point you in the right direction for help. On Facebook, we can be found. Facebook and Instagram is at Love Life Now Found. FOUND is the last word, but Love Life Now Found. And then on Twitter, it's Love Life Now Found without the D. So look us up. Join us on social media. A huge part of what we do is to be able to share on Instagram and Facebook the things that we're doing to encourage others to be able to speak out. So join us on social media, and I want to thank you guys for having me tonight. God bless you guys.
Well, God bless you, and thank you for being willing to come and share your story. It's been a blessing. We want to thank our listening audience for tuning in to this episode of Processing the Pain. And this month, October, we're bringing awareness to domestic violence. We ask that you'll continue to follow us every Wednesday for the month of October as we bring you special guests that will share their stories and the things that have been birthed out of their pain. There was birth out of the pain. So we want to ask that you continue to follow us on Wednesdays and then again on Thursday nights. Feel free to tune in to Processing the Pain, 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 9 p.m. Central Time, and 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Know that you are loved and appreciated.
Woman to woman, songs of life we sing, songs of love and songs of joy.
Sing it down low for him.
Oh.